Welcome to a podcast of Beyond the Book, a presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. Copyright Clearance Center is the world's largest provider of copyright compliance solutions through a wide range of innovative licensing services and comprehensive educational programs for authors, publishers, and their audiences in academia, business, and research institutions. For more information about Beyond the Book and Copyright Clearance Center, please go to www.beyondthebook.com.
Good afternoon. I'm Rich Barr, Deputy World Editor of the Miami Herald, where I manage our online political coverage, Political Currents, on miamiherald.com. I'm delighted to be here. Obviously, we have an important topic. Clearly, we know why it's a major issue in the presidential campaign, and I'm glad to see so many of you here. One housekeeping chore, been asked to remind everyone to turn your cell phones off as this panel discussion is being recorded. I want to make a brief mention about one of our panelists who could not be here this afternoon, Carol Rosenberg. She is military affairs correspondent of the Miami Herald, and I've had the pleasure of working with her as her editor on a number of occasions. She called me from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, yesterday to tell me that it was very uncertain that she would make it back in time for the for this panel, but of course she sends her regrets. Carol was in Baghdad just shortly after the collapse of Saddam Hussein's statue and has reported extensively from the Mideast. It's my pleasure to introduce the moderator for today's panel, Christopher Keneally. He is director of author and creator relations at the Copyright Clearance Center near Boston. He is an author, has reported from the Mideast and Central Asia in the past, has also written for the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the Los Angeles Times, and National Public Radio. It's my pleasure, as I said, to welcome Mr. Keneally.
The story we're about to hear is true. The names may have been changed to protect not only the innocent and the victims, but also, in some cases, the journalists who are reporting the story themselves. Hello, my name is Chris Keneally. I am, as you heard, the Director of Author Relations for Copyright Clearance Center, and welcome to a special edition of a program we call Beyond the Book. We're here as part of the 2007 Miami Book Fair International. Our program today will reflect on the contents of a single book, Reporting Iraq, published just last month by Melville House Publishing. It is an oral history of the war by the journalists who covered it. Reporting Iraq presents a side of the story we don't usually hear, the story of the storytellers themselves. Joining me today are Jane Araf, Mike Hoyt, and Colonel Dan Baggio. As ancient as war itself, writing on war is an esteemed tradition from Homer and Herodotus to Orwell and Capper as a photographer. In many respects, the Iraq War that began with the U.S. invasion in March 2003 is like any other in human history. But clearly, the tools we use to tell its story are as fresh as video cell phones and the blogosphere. Reporting Iraq is already being called required reading for journalism students, but I think its ambition should aim higher. At least one of our panelists has wondered out loud, why would the general public want to read such a book? When she asked me that, I was taken aback. Clearly, you do want to read this kind of a book. Of course they'll be interested, I replied. Aren't we all desperate to know what doesn't make it into the paper, what doesn't wind up on air? As good as any newscast or news feature may be, when it comes to a war so charged by politics and principles on all sides, as the war in Iraq is, our curiosity is all but endless. Maybe that's right or wrong, I'm not sure. And we can ask the panelists what they think. Maybe it's morbid somehow to want to know even more detail about what is likely by history to be judged a catastrophe for all concerned. But one thing's for sure, when this hour is over, we will all have, I think, a richer appreciation for just how hard the work is to report from Iraq. I want to start with Mike Hoyt. Mike, welcome.
Thank you.
Mike is the executive editor of the Columbia Journalism Review, where he has worked since 1986 as a writer and editor. Before that, he was a freelance magazine writer. He has also worked for Business Week and for two New Jersey dailies, The Record in Bergen County and The Home News. Mike, you're here to tell us the picture of the book itself and how it evolved. And I think it's important to start with how this assignment started.
Well, one of our contributing editors suggested it, and we jumped on it. One of the inspirations was a woman named Farnaz Fasihi, who works for the Wall Street Journal. She's a Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, a very respected reporter. She wrote she had a habit of writing an email to her friends and relatives in kind of a chain letter from Baghdad to let everyone know she was okay and a little bit about what was going on and so forth. And in mid-2004, I believe, she wrote one that was more discouraged and more worried, basically, about the situation and about her situation and about how difficult it was to report. She sent it, and somebody in the chain posted it, and it was instantly all over the world. And it was quite a controversy in journalistic circles and elsewhere, too, because it went beyond conventional journalism form. It was somewhat emotional. It was actually, I can read a little piece of it. I leave when I have very good reason to and a scheduled interview. I avoid going to people's homes and never walk in the streets. I can't go grocery shopping anymore. Can't eat in restaurants. Can't strike a conversation with strangers. Can't look for stories. Can't drive in anything but a full armored car. Can't go to the scenes of breaking news stories. Can't be stuck in traffic. Can't speak English outside. Can't take a road trip. Can't say I'm an American. Can't linger at checkpoints, can't be curious about what people are saying, doing, feeling, and can't. And so obviously she was feeling that. And it was controversial because some journalists thought, one, it made it sound like you can't report in Iraq, which they thought was not true, which isn't true. But secondly, she also voiced a little bit of political and a little deeper analysis. She thought that the mission over there was very troubled, obviously. This goes beyond, you know, the bounds of objectivity. But others thought that it was terrific. It actually, broke through. And, in fact, some of her readers emailed her to say, you know, you never told us how bad it was. And she said, you know, you've been reading my stuff for months. I've been telling you this. But there was something about the first person that broke through. And that's really what we wanted more of. I think we get a little numb to this war, and we wanted to break through that barrier. These people went through the full arc of this war from the beginning, when there were 400 reporters or more, and they were able to go anywhere. They were able to go to Fallujah or places where now you can't go unless you're embedded. And
there was a sense of euphoria, even. There was an excitement that all things seemed possible.
Well, actually, they universally in the book call it sort of the golden age or the golden period. You could talk to Iraqis. One reporter said not only you could talk to them, you couldn't shut them up. They were pouring out their stories. They had been bottled up for so long. And there was a euphoria to it. It was, reporters go to bear witness. They go to inform the American people, but they also go because it's interesting. And it's obviously fascinating. Here's a country undergoing a tremendous change. It's the biggest story in the world. So they went from that period to a period where they began to notice that Iraq was growing toxic, that there were problems, there were deep problems, and there were, we went from sort of control, a period of near chaos for a couple of months to a period where, of building insurgency and then into what looks like a civil war. So they, at different points along the way, noticed notice things. They noticed them, and sometimes faster than the government did, and many times faster than the government did. So we wanted to tell their story of these people. Some of them, you know, were there since before the war. They know things. They have an authority, and we wanted their perspective on Iraq, not just how they do their job, but on the war effort as well.
And to address the question I asked at the beginning about why is it important for the public to know that, you mentioned the numbing effect of story after story and report after report. If this is a book that points to the future, what kind of future for journalism do you see emerging out of the war? What kind of legacy for the media may there be?
Well, I think the public cares about Iraq. The public is a little numbed about Iraq right now, but I think they care deeply, and I think this is another window into it. That's one reason to find out, you know, more about the country, about what's happening with the war effort. I think the reporters catch it, you know, from all sides. This is a somewhat divided country, and they catch it from the left for not, you know, paying enough attention to the dire problems, to civilian casualties, to that kind of thing. They catch it from the right for not paying attention to the good news and the successes and sometimes the valor that goes on. But I think if you read the book, you will see that how hard it is to do. It's very, very hard. And to get it right, and to not pay attention to those pressures.
And what a serious job it is. People are, it's a job you never leave. You can't walk away from the office or the desk and never be done. It's something that happens to you on a constant basis.
Yeah, I mean, I think early on it was one kind of job. Suddenly it became another kind of job. I mean, there are story after story here of in a chapter we call Turning Points, where people began to experience things like being chased by gunmen or being threatened, gun to the head. Dexter Filkins of the New York Times happens upon a car bomb, and the crowd turns on him and nearly kills him. And his very large bodyguard throws him in the car, and the crowd nearly holds the car back. A crowd that big can do that, but they get away. One after another. You know, there are stories like that where people, realize that things were turning south. Not sure where I was going with that.
There was at one point a kind of glamorous image of the war correspondent. Do any of the students at Columbia at UC think of the war or reporting from a war as a glamorous occupation? How do they view it before they ever show up?
Well, that's interesting. I had in doing this book, I had the privilege of meeting some of these people, and I had dinner with a young reporter, formerly Boston Globe, I had dinner with her and her father, and her father talked about getting a phone call from her as she was riding on some armored vehicle behind the troops going, you know, heading for Baghdad at the very beginning of the war. And he said that, you know, he and her mother were, their first emotion was deep worry, of course. Their second was, worry about, you know, the effects on her. She was obviously going to see devastation. And then the third emotion, and her father is an old CBS reporter, her third emotion was jealousy. He felt a twinge of jealousy, and he wanted to be there. And of course, it is interesting. I think as the war has gone on, it's obviously changed characters. I think it's become just extremely difficult now. There's a psychic price to pay. I mean, some people talk about that. And I would not advise any student to go over there. Now, I actually had a student who ended up in the book who went over there, unbeknownst to me, but he went over there and started stringing early on, named Andrew Butterworth. He did stuff for Time Magazine and some others, and he's quite good. But he's not going. He's back, and I don't think he'll be going again. I think now it's I don't know what your bureau was like, but I've heard described the Times bureau, for example, which has machine guns up top and guards all over the place, and it's the work. Much of the work is done by Iraqis, who many of whom have paid for it with their lives. So it's not a It's not a job to send a student.
The story that ends the book, I wonder if you can tell us about it, and perhaps I'd encourage you to read from it. It's too bad we can't hear all the various voices. There are something like 36 reporters and photojournalists involved in this project, at least, right? How many were interviewed?
46 we used.
46, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So there are that many voices, and they sort of come in and out and tell a story that adds up at the end of the book with one very dramatic story. Can you tell us about that and perhaps choose a section from it?
There is a section at the end of the book. Chris Hondros is a really wonderful reporter. Photojournalist, sorry. And he tells a story that really, to my mind, I put it at the end because I thought it said something about the mission. The basic story is he went on patrol with a group. I forget who they were, but
Apache Company, I think.
It was in Tal Afar. This is in 2005, January 2005, and they got in a firefight, and a few shots were fired, and he hung around, and he had something of a camaraderie with them, and they worked together. A couple of days later, they went out on a late afternoon patrol, and I'll just read a little bit. It's a long section, so I'll pick a chunk here. Finally, on Tuesday, the same guys, the Apache guys who were in the firefight, were going out in a late afternoon patrol. So I said, all right, I'll go on that. But they got delayed. So finally at 6 we went out, and it was the same kind of thing, a little smaller, like a small group of 20 men or so patrolling, and it was dark by this point. So they're out on the streets, and it's after the curfew, which is about 6 o'clock, as we were. And as we were patrolling on a darkened boulevard, in the distance, a car, maybe 100 yards down at least, turned toward the boulevard and started coming toward us. And already I had a bad feeling, you know, because these are camouflaged soldiers. They don't patrol regularly. They don't call much attention to themselves, because if they have lights and sirens and things like that, they'd be seen or be easily attacked. So here's a bunch of testy men with guns running around and a car coming towards them, and they don't let cars come toward them. I had a feeling the situation was going to end up badly. So I moved over to the side because I feared at least some warning shots would be fired. The car kept coming. It was dark. Sure enough, somebody fired some warning shots. The car kept coming. And then they fired into the car, and it limped into the intersection, clearly no longer under its own power, just on its own momentum, and gently came to rest on a curb. I was kind of paralyzed and then slowly walked to the car, and sure enough, I hear children's voices inside the car, and I knew it was a family. Well, you get the picture.
You get the picture. And in fact, he got the pictures, and that becomes part of the story. Sort of fast forward to that, there was an entire family of Iraqis. They were going home. Nobody really keeps track of 6 o'clock, 6:01. Now it's curfew, and you shouldn't be out there. And they were wrong place, wrong time.
Wrong place, wrong time, which happens more than it should. And
but the photos.
The photos, it ends up that both parents are dead. Little boy is shot and I think paralyzed, and the little girl survives, but she's bloodied and, of course, hysterical. And he quietly takes pictures, and they go back to the base, and then the PR people from the military begin to think about this. They realize something tough is going to go out, and there's a conversation. You kind of have to read it because it's a little confusing, but there's a conversation. They said, we'd like to do a little investigating before you send those out. And he says, sure, and he runs back, and he says, but I have to send them to my boss, and you can talk to my boss. Sends him to his. He looks. He wasn't sure what he had because it was low light. And when he saw what he had, he was shocked because they were very powerful pictures. And he hits send as fast as he can. Sends them out. Walks back tell the guy to talk to his boss. They agree they'd talk in the morning. The colonel goes to bed. The captain, I think, takes over and talks in the morning. And there's a confusing conversation. We don't hear it, but all we know is the captain actually, the captain goes to bed thinking the pictures are not going to be sent. They are. And big trouble in the morning. The colonel has steam's coming out of his ears and so forth. They didn't really want those pictures out, or if they did, I guess it depends. Maybe you can shed light on this. They didn't want them out, but at least they wanted warning that they're coming out, and they didn't get either. And it was, you know, he ends his last line is, it was a confusing situation. But to me, it says something. Whatever happened, I'm not sure what happened in those conversations, but the mission of the journalist is to show what happened. The mission of the military, they can speak for themselves, but the mission of the journalist is to show the story, even when it's a rough story.
Jane Arif, welcome. Jane is a freelance NBC News correspondent, and before joining NBC, she was the Edward R. Murrow Press Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. That followed her 8 years as CNN's Baghdad bureau chief, as well as Istanbul bureau chief and senior Baghdad correspondent. And Jane, I want to just sort of go right to that about your 2 years, or nearly so, as an embedded reporter in Iraq, and the mission of the journalist and the mission of the military, and where they overlap and where they conflict. And just share with us your thoughts on that.
Thanks. That is sort of an essential question, I suppose, and where they overlap, where you would hope they overlap, and sometimes they do, actually, oddly enough, is that I feel it's our job to go out there, take those risks, and come back, and if I'm doing television, show you what we've seen and put it in context so you can actually decide how it's going. It's not up to us to do that. Where those things don't overlap is that very often the military, with the exception of Colonel Baggio here, will feel that the reason journalists are there is to help them win the war. The reason journalists are there is to be cheerleaders for them. I've been asked to put on uniforms. I've been asked why we're not helping more with the war effort. And when I try to explain that as a longtime journalist, I feel that one is a journalist first and your nationality second, it's shocking to many of them. I'm not saying that everyone has to feel that way, but that is the way a lot of us feel. And it's a difficult thing to get across to young men and women who are out there risking their lives for various reasons. But there is still a big difference there between how we see ourselves and the job we should be doing and how the military sees us. Now, having said that, just again, very briefly, there are enlightened commanders, enlightened soldiers, non-commissioned officers who have made it possible for most of the reporting that you all would have seen from the war, whether it's the battle for Fallujah, the fall of Baghdad, and everything else. It can't be the only thing that you see. It can't be the only thing you use to decide how things are going, but it has been an essential part of being out there reporting on Baghdad and on Iraq in general.
Mike said that he wouldn't send anybody to Iraq, but you told me you think there should be more, not fewer journalists in Iraq. Why is that?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong. I think what Mike is saying is that he wouldn't send a journalism student or a recent journalism student to Iraq.
Okay.
And I do think there has to be more reporting on Iraq simply because we're hearing fewer and fewer voices. And part of that is because there are fewer journalists. Part of it is because it's harder to get out there. It's become more dangerous. Part of it, I have to say, is because there is a feeling that the American public has tuned out. I don't know if you all realize how hard it is to get on air with an Iraq story, but, you know, get a Britney Spears story up there and we do not have a chance. And for all the talk that journalists only want to show bad news, in all the years that I've covered Iraq and I've covered that war from the start, the stories that really get a lot of play are the ones with the most explosions. I covered the entire battle for Fallujah, live coverage, RPGs going off, mortars, very dramatic stuff. And then when it came time to rebuild Fallujah, and there were, I think, equally compelling stories with fewer explosions, there wasn't a whole lot of interest in seeing a family move back into their house and buy the bricks to build their house again.
Well, you mentioned all the years that you covered Iraq, but it wasn't just the war that brought you to Iraq. You were in Iraq for 15, 16 years, really. So when you return there, and you were most recently there in September, you return and see it almost, I'll say this, almost with Iraqi eyes. What is it like to be in Iraq today for someone who remembers it from 10, 15 years ago?
It's absolutely heartbreaking, and I think the longer that you've spent in Baghdad, the more heartbreak there is inherent in that. Heartbreaking because a lot of the people that I knew are gone, whether they have left the country, whether they've died, whether they've had relatives killed. The cumulative effect of this war, and I think we're only coming to grips now with the effect that this war will have on America, but the effect in Iraq is that there has not really been a family that has been untouched. And in Baghdad, that means it's very difficult to find a family that has not lost a relative, that hasn't had somebody die in a sectarian killing or killed in a crossfire or died in some other way, or hasn't had their home confiscated, hasn't had something truly terrible happen to them. So I almost envy reporters who come in and see things with that fresh eye, where they don't know all the baggage that comes with looking around a city that you knew and seeing it destroyed and seeing the ghosts of people that you knew. But at the same time, I suppose what I'd like to see is more people who knew Baghdad and more Iraqis reporting. And, you know, I have to say, I won't take too long, but I do think one of the positive things of, if there is a positive thing, of the danger and difficulty in Westerners reporting in Iraq is that it has produced a new generation of Iraqi journalists. And when I first went to Iraq, the only Iraqi journalists worked for the Iraqi government, and no one really believed that you could be an independent journalist who didn't work for some government. And now we're actually seeing them, and it's amazing, and they are incredibly courageous. And at some point, we are going to hand the torch even more to these Iraqi journalists, and that's how you're going to be able and hopefully be able to get news about what really is going on in the places we can no longer go to.
Well, Jane, you mentioned the legacy for America of the war. And when one thinks of the Vietnam War, it had multiple legacies. It had a legacy for the media. It probably was the moment when a mistrust or a distrust or a questioning of the media began in earnest. Do you have any thoughts on what the legacy for the media will be of this conflict? Will it just be to completely end any sense that everyone doesn't have an agenda? Do people always question what it is you're up to?
I think one of the things I grapple with, and a lot of us grapple with, is the polarization of American society. And when it comes to how they see the news, how they evaluate the news, generally what I've found is that whether people believe my reports or not, and again, I've done a lot of live television. So the wonderful thing about live television is it's there, it's happening in real time, and it's hard to put a spin on it quite so much. But whether people believe it or not tends to be determined by what they think of the war. And I think that that has been fueled partly because of the questions that we should have asked before the war, in the run-up to this war. And I think it's partly because of the rise of the internet and all those other things, the blogs, the fact that Americans who don't like what they're reading in their newspapers or seeing on TV can go onto the internet and find out what Sergeant Jones from Alabama thinks the war is, how the war is going. And all of that, I think, has fragmented what used to be a pretty cohesive viewership to the point where it's really harder not just to get people's attention, it's harder to get people to trust you.
I want to turn now for an interesting perspective to Colonel Dan Baggio. He is currently the Chief of Army Media Relations, assigned to the Office of the Chief of Army Public Affairs at the Pentagon. He's had 24 years of active duty, including 11 overseas commands and staff positions in Korea, Japan, Turkey, and elsewhere. And Colonel Baggio, welcome. And I guess I want to just sort of ask you first about your relationship with the media. I think people here would love to hear what that is exactly. You told me some of your best friends are journalists.
That's very true. Actually, I knew Jane fairly well, and we were over there before, and she's an excellent reporter. And I'm not saying that to try to cheese up to her at all. But the truth of it is, when you talk about honest and fair reporting, I mean, honesty, live shots. I mean, I guess the thing that bothers me about reporters who come with a preset agenda and are not even, and if you have an agenda, at least be open to what you see. I mean, if Jane tells something that I do like or that I don't like, it doesn't matter. I know she's being truthful. She was out there frankly, in some of the toughest stuff in that second battle of Fallujah, right out front with her helmet on, reporting. It was impressive to see her out there with the 1st Infantry Division. We were talking before we came in here, and really I always view media like any other profession. I mean, you can't paint them all in one corner. It's a spectrum. And one of the things that I try to do as a military, I'm really the liaison between the media and the military.
Right. In fact, Colonel, maybe you can just give people a 30-second take on what the role is and how that works in Iraq.
Well, I'm not in Iraq now, so I can't speak for what's going on there at right now. But what I really believe in is I try to facilitate the media to tell their story, to try to, if they got needs, they want to visit a unit, I try to get them out there to tell their story. Obviously, the military, we have our talking points. We have, like any corporation or any company, there are certain things that we want to tell, relevant information about our organization. But other than that, we want to provide access and not try to spin anybody, but give them access to things, the good and the bad, to include Abu Ghraib. I took the first group of folks out to see the aftermath of Abu Ghraib. Matter of fact, Carol Rosenberg, who's not with us today, I think was in that busload of people that I took out there. And things like that are painful, but I think I too think it's important to get it out there because the public needs to know. I mean, for every 100 attaboys, one aw shucks kind of wipes them all out, and those are tough to live with. But I think those hard biting things are important as well. But I will tell you that as far as relations with the media are concerned, one of the things that I try to do is I try to develop personal relationships with them to understand what they want, what they need. And I think that's important because there's a natural friction between the military and the media. It's natural, and you got to understand that friction or tension because, we're concerned with security. We got a mission to do. We want to save soldiers' lives. We've got certain objectives we've got to accomplish. And at the same time, the media have their First Amendment rights. They've got a story to tell. And so the natural culture of the military is to keep information in, the natural culture of the journalists is to tell information. So I'm there telling guys, well, hey, we're trying to change the culture of engagement, say it's okay to talk to the media. It's okay to do that. So that makes it doubly harder for me when you introduce a certain media who's on this end of the spectrum who maybe doesn't have the same sort of integrity or doesn't treat things the right way. Because then when a person like that does a story that you think is less than fair, then it has effects on what the attitude of the military is. So I do a lot of massaging and a lot of work with our folks, and we try to encourage engagement. Matter of fact, right now within the U.S. Army, I can't speak for the whole military, we've got something called Initiative 7. But basically what it is we're encouraging all of our folks to engage the media, talk to the media. We've got a program called 3-2-1 now where we even have our senior leaders, and talk about a throwback or actually just a polar opposite from the stigma of Vietnam. We're trying to encourage leaders to once a quarter, starting with the generals, and it trickles down to do 3 engagements with what we call community outreach, like speeches, those kinds of things, 2 things with the media, and then 1 thing with our own internal public affairs apparatus, our base newspapers, our Pentagon Channel, those sorts of things. So it doesn't happen overnight, but we're trying to encourage folks to engage more. And I think it's very important because we have an important story to tell, even with the warts, but I think overall, there's a lot of soldiers and Marines, airmen, sailors out there doing really hard work and unappreciated, and I think each one of those guys has a story to tell, and it takes people like this to tell those stories. So overall, I'm always, like people say, cautiously optimistic. I'm always cautiously optimistic about the relationship, but I think it takes hard work, and I think it's important for us to have a great relationship.
I would like to ask you whether you have an opinion on who needs each other more. I mean, clearly the military needs the media to tell that story, and the media needs the military, and if you can sort of weigh that, and then Jane, perhaps you could tell us what you think of that question.
Yeah. I mean, don't know, you could almost say 50-50 on the one hand. But it's interesting, Jane mentioned briefly that we're in this global information environment now where you have all the things like the webs, blogs, you have YouTube. It's an environment where people get their news not from necessarily the traditional news sources, which makes it challenging for us. And there are some who will tell me, they'll say, "Well, why do we even need media? We can tell the story our own way." Well, I think it is good to post our own things up there on our own websites and things, but I think there's always going to be a fundamental need to engage because people watch TV, they pick up a newspaper in the morning, and they read it. So I think it's something that we have to sustain. It's definitely important for us. I don't know about percentages. I would guess it's about equally beneficial.
And Jane, what do you think about that?
Okay, please don't take this the wrong way. We don't believe your press releases quite so much. And I don't think the public does either. And that doesn't mean that they're wrong, and that doesn't mean you're not really well-meaning. And again, Colonel Baggio, not because he's sitting next to me, really is. I have to point out that he is kind of like the poster boy for really good media relations people. They're not all like him. They're not all as charming and articulate. But anyway, the reason that the military needs us, I think, is because if they're telling us that they are, let's see, they've launched an airstrike and 15 insurgents have been killed and Al-Qaeda has been routed from a town in western Al-Anbar, I would hope that nobody is going to print that verbatim or put that on air without actually being out there. It's very difficult to check, and that's one of the disturbing things now about not being able to get out quite so much is when you get out there, if you're there and you have to be there, and particularly for television, there's no substitute for being there, you will find very often that there was an airstrike, that there were some people killed. It's very difficult to figure out whether they're insurgents, even for the military. It's so complex there that if they're going to get across key parts of their story, they do need someone to interpret that part of the story for them. We need them because you can't just roam around Iraq these days. In fact, you can't walk across the street in some places these days, and that's why we rely on them to essentially give us access, not only to take us to places, to talk to us, to tell us what they're thinking, to introduce us to Iraqi leaders who we also can't get to. We rely on the military these days for pretty well everything when it comes to anything to do with military operations. Those days when you could actually just walk up and cover both sides of the conflict were gone a few years ago. So we're inextricably linked, I'd say.
In the book, there are at least a couple of anecdotes from reporters who resent that in some way, that they are reliant on the military. And one reporter talks about certain reporters using the Black Hawk helicopters as taxis, and she seems to think that that's cheating somehow. You don't feel that way.
I have never understood why, if you had a tool, you wouldn't use it. You know, if I'm standing in the rain in New York City and a taxi's going by, I'm going to take that taxi. If I'm in Baghdad and some general says, "I'm flying north today, do you want to fly with me?" Why in the world would I not do that? Now, I think that criticism perhaps comes from a perception that reporters who are getting on generals' helicopters are doing nothing but getting on generals' helicopters. And if that were the case, that is disturbing. But if you are using that, as any journalist does and will, as just another tool and just another piece of a very complicated puzzle, then I can't imagine how that could be wrong.
And Colonel, a last question for you. I asked you when we were getting ready for all of this, why would a man who had been in the infantry for so long want to move over to public affairs? And you said it can be pretty exciting itself, and perhaps you have a story that illustrates that for us.
Well, it is. It's next to carrying an M4 and clearing trenches and that sort of thing. The media military relationship thing. I mean, I'm in a knife fight every day. And my boss, General Kukul, says that all the time, but it's very, very true. I mean, I do deal with a wide spectrum of issues, everything from good, bad, in between, controversial, not so controversial, mundane to thrilling, I guess. But it is a very exciting business. One thing I just do got to have to comment. The one thing that I have is my integrity, and it's just kind of a piggyback on Jane's. I appreciate the kind comments from Jane on that. But the folks that I've worked with, you know, as far as being a public affairs professional, you know, I can lie to you once. Then once I'm caught, I'll never be effective again. I might be effective once, and then that's it. So, you know, I'm all for telling the truth. There's obviously certain things that involve operational security that we can't talk about, but engagement within bounds is very important. On the contrary, I think one of the things that concerns me, and I'll give you just an anecdote, not about Iraq, but it's an anecdote when I was in Korea that I saw once, not as a public affairs officer, but it's one of the reasons that I wanted to become a public affairs officer relevant to this question, is there's an old exercise we used to do called Team Spirit, which was a big return of forces to Korea, and it's a big logistics thing, a maneuver exercise. It's huge. So At that time, I was a infantry battalion personnel officer, and we had two new lieutenants that came in theater. I had to pick them up and bring them to the maneuver box. Well, anyway, long story short, we got lost in the middle of Seoul, and we're driving an overpass, and I notice one of the little universities there, and they're kind of like a little clamshell-shaped sort of a structure, and there's a group of protesters. It's kind of the spring ritual that happens every year there, with a line of these Seoul riot police there. And then there was news cameras back there taking pictures of this little riot, but across the street, there's a grandma and a granddaughter, you know, eating ice cream cones, people going to shops, people just going about the business. But the funny thing is, you watch the news that night, and the camera picks up, and you think all of Korea was on fire, and there was a huge riot. Because I remember my mom and dad called me, and it doesn't matter, I'm 48 years old, I'm still my mom and dad's little boy. But at the time, they called me and said, man, you got to be careful in Korea. The whole place is... I said, it is? I don't know. I didn't see that. But that's one of the things. I paint that example, is that sometimes those folks who want to blow up a story, make it bigger than what it is, that's also dangerous. And so there's all people aren't like Jane on the media side of the house. So I just think it's something that's very important to nurture the relationship. It's an exciting business. I have no regrets. Well, sometimes I have regrets, but generally speaking, I have no regrets for getting in public affairs. I tell you what, I think probably... it's rewarding, but very frustrating, but probably some of the hardest work I've done since I've been in the military.
Mike, just finally, before we go to questions from the audience, and we want to encourage you to stay to ask questions of anyone here that you'd like to. For Columbia Journalism Review, are you following through on this? Will there be more looking at the reporting in Iraq and the way that Iraq is changing reporting itself? Do you have any projects?
Yeah, certainly. We're actually sending one of our staff writers to Iraq probably in January, partly to look at something that the colonel mentioned or somebody mentioned. There are a lot of what they call mill blogs out there, which are sometimes soldiers, ex-soldiers, and that kind of thing. And talk about a range. Some of them are very good and very, very good, and some of them are really not good. And he wants to take a look at them, and he's going to go actually with a couple of them and see what they report versus what is real, or what he sees from his perspective. I just wanted to mention one thing in response to something earlier. In the book, it didn't. There's incidents of military press tension in the book, certainly, but it didn't come through as the theme that I expected it to. And what does come through strongly to me is the tension between the especially when Mr. Bremer was in charge, the coalition provisional authority, between the politicians and the press. They seem to see, they painted a picture in their press conferences of something that was totally different from what the reporters who were going around and actually seeing with their eyes were seeing. And it got almost comical to some of them, because a new reporter would come in and express frustration ask a question. This isn't what I'm seeing. And they'd say, oh, there's the fresh eye. You know?
Right. All the old hands would kind of roll their eyes.
Yeah. And there's a story in there of a guy from the CPA who was complaining about the reporter was complaining about the gas shortage, and the guy in the green zone didn't know about it, and all of Baghdad knew about it. And you know, it's just that tension was much more pronounced.
one is completely neutral. You're shaped by your upbringing. You're shaped by the things you've seen. I've certainly been shaped by all of the things that I've seen unfold in front of me in Iraq. And it means that when you go to write a sentence or say a sentence on television, in the back of your mind, I think a lot of us think to ourselves, okay, am I missing anything? What is it that I'm missing? And that's, I think, a lot of what good journalism is about, knowing what you're missing and trying to compensate for it. So it takes an effort.
One of the frustrations that I think that we're seeing now is that just recently, a few days ago, we had a Lieutenant Jackson was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross, the second highest award next to the Medal of Honor. And it was, matter of fact, we had a lot of networks, CNN, ABC, most of the networks were there covering it, but we had trouble getting print people. Unfortunately, the ceremony was like 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a Friday, and it was hard to get people to cover it. So I think the frustrating thing for us right now is people who don't want to tell the hero stories as much, whereas a lot of times when you see stories out there that, like the Abu Ghraibs, those kinds of things, there's never any lack of want for folks wanting to tell those stories. But it's a little bit more challenging to tell the heroic stories. And then, so if we can't make them compelling, and budgets and all that sort of thing are going to be a factor. I mean, I think that could be the factor from the military side.
I'm prejudiced. I think most reporters are intellectually honest, but I think that's just part of the makeup. Of course, there are bad cops, there are bad judges, there are bad doctors, there are bad reporters. But I also think that war reporters tend to be among the best of us. I really do. I think they have a something about them wants to bear witness, and I don't think you go to Iraq. There's no need to sensationalize. There's plenty of sensation.
Read multiple sources. You can't read everything. But what I do is I call it battle rhythm. There's certain things I'll look at, and I'll look at those consistently. But it's got to be a spectrum, and just kind of that way you'll get a feel. I do agree. Most journalists that I've dealt with are pretty straightforward. There are some with agendas. I've ran into some of those. And one of the other problems are I've met great journalists who have had editors higher up who have taken out portions of their stories or put other things in it. And the journalist has come to me to talk to me about it and felt frustrated. But generally speaking, I think it's usually not that great an issue, but there are some. And but what I always tell the soldiers who ask me that same question, read other things. If you think one source is wrong, read something else. And if you start seeing it's the same thing, well, then maybe that'll convince you.
It is a really depressing story to cover year after year. And I want to see progress. I want to see good things happening. And every time, essentially, I try to do a story that involves Iraqis of good news. I was doing a story on a Shia woman who was marrying a Sunni man to show that people are still being intermarried. And then when I went back to try to follow up on that story, to try to actually film it, I was told, well, actually, the bride was killed. So I can't tell you how many stories end like that. So it's complicated. It's sad. There are some positive things, but if you look at the major trends so far, they've been less than positive, I'd say.
It takes intellectual honesty and courage and smarts and persistence and it's a job. If you're going to spend millions and millions of dollars and take on this enterprise that sort of gambles with history and in which tens of thousands of people lose their lives, and you need independent witnesses to that to honestly tell you how it's going. I admire the people who do it.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Colonel Baggio.
Thank you.
Beyond the Book is an educational presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center, with conferences and seminars featuring leading authors and editors, publishing analysts, and information technology specialists. Beyond the Book is the premier source for knowledge on the latest business issues facing today's dynamic publishing industry, from initial research to final publication and beyond.